Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Jason Wolner, who's best known from Human Giant, Eagle Heart, directing just many of the best comedy TV shows of the last decade, and, most important for our purposes, directing last year's Borat subsequent movie film. Good One is this show about how the hell comedy is made, and there's no one who has a process like Sacha Baron Cohen. I so distinctly remember finding out how they did Borat, where they're like, we have tons of writers essentially scripting out all possible options for what a person might say, and then Sacha memorizes it, so no matter what, he's ready. And there's like a story about he got so drunk and he passed out and then they woke him up and he woke up in character. And I'm like, this is the most interesting thing I've ever heard. Jason was also fascinated by Sacha's work even while working with him. So it was a blast to talk to Jason about how they made that movie. The scene we're going to play comes fairly early in the movie after Borat decides he's going to make over his daughter Tutar, played by newcomer Maria Bakalova, with the hopes of giving her as a gift to Mike Pence. While doing that, Borat sort of warms up to Tutar, and he decides to buy her a cupcake that has a little plastic baby on top of it. And she eats the whole thing, including the little plastic baby. No, this is a comedy scene. Everything is scripted. However, Borat has the idea to take her to a crisis pregnancy center. The pastor they then talk to, as is Sacha's style, is a real person. So, here is Jason Wolner.
I have a baby inside me, mm-hmm. and I want to take it out of me.
Mm-hmm. Right. She wants it out now, please.
Right.
Can you take it out?
No, we cannot. That's not what we do here.
And why not?
What you say, take it out.
Yes.
You end that life. That life will die.
Right, it's already dead. It's not living.
No, it is living right now. It has
right, this big.
It has a heartbeat right now.
I don't think so.
It is a living, breathing life that God has created.
I don't think he's breathing.
We can show you that it's breathing.
It hurt my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And it will hurt my asshole.
Mm-hmm.
If it come out, yes, because the arm like this. It can tear it.
Right.
I feel bad because I was the one who put the baby in her.
You don't need to feel bad.
I was just trying to give my daughter pleasure, and next thing I know, there is a baby inside her.
Mm-hmm. You keep calling her your daughter.
Yes.
Okay. Is he your father?
Yes.
This
yes.
is your daughter?
Yes.
Okay.
I wanted to give my daughter a treat.
I understand. I don't
if
need
she
to hear
was,
any, I don't need to hear any more of that. I understand.
She just had
that.
But look at that face.
I understand.
How could I not give it
I
to
understand.
Her? Would
I,
you have not given it
I
to
understand.
Her?
I understand. Listen, that is not important right now. We're at this moment. It really doesn't matter how we got to this moment.
When he treat me, he said this will be our little secret.
Yes, this is why I do it behind the dumpster, so no one can see. Now that you know that I am her father, can we take it out now, please?
God is the one who creates life, and God doesn't make accidents.
I am here with Jason Wallner. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
So I want to go back to November 2006. I believe you were working on the first season of Human Giant at that point, but that is when the first Borat came out. Do you remember what you expected going into it? And tell me everything you remember from seeing it for the first time.
The only actual specific memory I have is, I think, the same memory that everyone has, which is just screaming with laughter at the whole movie, and especially, you know, the naked fight, and just the overall experience of it. I think I went with at least Aziz and probably the other Human Giant guys. Yeah, we were working on that show, and it was just such a moment that, yeah, I remember that first weekend, just this thing came out that I know I had been aware. I'd watched the Ali G show on HBO and was a fan already and was excited, but it was just that kind of thing where something crosses over from comedy nerd mm-hmm. world, and then suddenly everyone enjoys it and falls in love with it. And that was, you know, it's really rare where something like that works for people who are on all sides of the political spectrum and, you know, super brainy, and also, you know, the kind of like frat boys that are mm-hmm. in Borat in the RV are also the kind of guys that would, you know, go crazy about that movie, and also the types of people that would be quoting it for the next decade and a half. And it just really, it hit something where it was just the biggest thing, and everyone went crazy for it.
Considering it came out while you're working sort of on your first big project, did it influence you in any way? Did it influence how do you approach your work there or your work going forward?
If anything, I would say it was great proof that something does not have to look classically great to be funny. The movie looks perfect. It looks exactly as it should. But, you know, it was completely the opposite of like slick comedies, everything very punchy and lit and locked down and broad. And of course, because it was a documentary in a lot of ways, it kind of just everything supported the realism, which is the same way we shot this movie, which is almost no lights at all, just two or three cameras following him around, you know, positioned in certain ways to capture what's going on in a specific way, to capture people's looks. You know, we had a lot of, and I watched the original Borat while we were making this many, many, many times, just to kind of really try to figure out exactly every little thing they did that made it work. And in terms of like when you're covering a scene with two people, you know, if you've only got two cameras, you're going to have to choose who do you have better eyes on, as we say, who's got, you know, more of a frontal view. And usually that's the person reacting. It's kind of, he'll ask a question, and then when we go to the person, the real person, you want to see as much of their face as possible.
Yeah. November 2016, Donald Trump is elected president. Clearly, Sasha was affected by this and motivated by it very clearly in the work that he did. But, you know, besides being sort of generally feeling bad, did it affect how you thought about your work, regardless if you felt like I need to make political comedy? But did it just, you know, did it affect you in any way of like, you know, what am I doing and why am I doing it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think it affected us all in every possible way, because it was one of those shifts that the entire world feels so different. If you remember from 2015 to 16, it was just this, it was like falling off a cliff, and just this story of Obama and progress and this very nice feeling that we had of what we were going towards was suddenly revealed that it wasn't the story we were living in. So everything came into question. I mean, I remember around then, it just felt very scary that there were, because so much of the alt-right was tied into kind of this kind of gnarled version that a lot of it came from kind of alt comedy of the 90s, that if you look through like you look at like kind of 90s alt comedy, Mr. Show vibe, someone like Gavin McInnes, kind of like a hanger-on to that scene, became friends with a lot of those guys. I was familiar with him. I'd met him a few times. Didn't make it in that world, and kind of in this like supervillain kind of way, because he couldn't make it as a comedian, kind of turned that ironic edginess. Mm. And you saw that a lot in Vice. There was a lot of meanness there and a lot of kind of reverence that really kind of went into like a very ugly place. And he went fully, and now he's the founder of, like, you know, one of the most notable hate groups in America. And so I remember at the time being like, oh my God, like, is this what comedy became? Is this what's edgy now? And it was a whole kind of reconciling of, just what was going to be funny moving forward. I mean, also, like, Trump changed everything because he's the funniest person who's ever lived. He's the best poster that Twitter ever had. You look at those tweets, I mean, there's something genuinely funny, not intentionally, sometimes intentionally, but I don't know. I have this whole convoluted thing where I feel like, and this is a real ramble, but I feel like we were in this kind of comedy boom. Twitter blew up and turned everyone into a comedian, like a late night monologue comedian. Just suddenly it reprogrammed everyone's brain into just doing these like jokes. It made all of our brains into just like one-liner machines. And I was like, what the fuck are we doing? And then Trump came along and he's like, well, I'm going to just do that better than anybody else. I'm going to be funnier on Twitter. Something about it was this really insanely dark cartoon that became real and made all comedy irrelevant. And that's why you see so many talk shows stop being funny and just angry and spinning out. And when you would take Trump and try to exaggerate what he did to make fun of him, it doesn't work because he was already at the peak absurdity. Yeah. The fact that this was happening.
How did it affect what you wanted to do with your work, considering he melted so much of what we thought of as, like, this is what comedy is. Like, in so much as he melted our definition of what everything is, clearly comedy was a big part of that. How did then, like, in the ashes of that, what did you feel like, what is my place in this world?
You know, I've just been on my own kind of weird path for a few years. I mean, I did a few things, like 2007-08, I did Human Giant. I was fortunate enough that I was able to have a directing career after that and direct, and I worked on TV shows. And then I figured out pretty quickly I didn't want to be like a director for hire on TV shows, because I respect what they do, but it wasn't the best fit. When I would just come into a place where I didn't know anyone and didn't know the show or didn't love the show and try to make decisions that for a thing that I didn't think was funny. There are a few shows that I did that I do love. Like, I did a lot of episodes of Last Man on Earth. I think Will Forte is one of the funniest people alive. I love that show. I love all those people. Like, so I did a little bit of that here and there, but mostly I was like, I don't want to be doing this. And then I had the opportunity at Adult Swim. I did this show called Eagle Heart. We did it for 3 seasons, and we really, and I just kind of like dug in, and myself and Andrew Weinberg and Michael Komen, who created the show, it was basically the three of us just doing exactly what we wanted to see and what we thought was funny, and kind of trying to do something with narrative and do a new kind of thing and generate laughs in a new way and just kind of find a new tone. So I kind of dug in on that. We did it for a few years, and then we were really itching to kind of broaden that out and bring what we figured out there into a place where more people could see it or do something on a bigger scale. Yeah. And then, like everyone, just kind of years of pitching and pilots and failed projects that don't get off the ground. And so from around 2014, for a few years, including through Trump, I was just kind of trying to just like continuing to dig in on this very weird stuff that ultimately wasn't getting made, trying to get more and more personal Stranger Things going and not really, I mean, not having a ton of success. Brett Gelman and I did 3 specials for Adult Swim.
Yeah.
And that, like, one of them we played at Sundance, and it's like crossed over a little bit. But yeah, a lot of the time, the last few years, including, so Trump, I mean, when Trump came into office, this is crazy. I've never talked to anyone about this because I still maybe will do something one day with it. But I had spent a year. I'm not really able to, because of the climate or whatever, get what I want going on TV and movies, certainly. Like, so actually, like, around that time, okay, 2 things. So Andrew Weinberg, who I did Eagle Heart with, we, around 2014, we were obsessed with conspiracy theories, which were so quaint back then, which were like totally different, which was like lizard people and chemtrails and all this stuff. And so we wrote this movie, and this one we're not going to make, so I can talk about it. So we wrote a movie that was basically about a guy who, and nothing, this is pre-Trump, this is, he's not even running yet. We came up with this movie about a guy, like kind of a dumb guy, who finds out that he is at the center of like a massive global conspiracy that ties in everything. Sure. So basically, like the, and this is, okay, this shows you how kind of far off our instincts were from what could actually get made. Like the movie begins with this like kind of like dumb loner guy watching the news in some city in America. And the news is like, horrible news today. There's been another terrorist attack. This building, you know, blew up, and they think it was like this unmarked, you know, van. It was similar to like the first World Trade Center attack. There's a van parked in the basement, and we don't know who's doing it. And or they blame, you know, some terrorist group and blah, 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 or blah, blah. And the guy is like so mad, and he's like to online. He's like, they got to catch the guys who did this. Anyway, got to go to work. And his job is parking unmarked vans under buildings and then leaving. And so just like complete idiot, not aware that he is like the stooge as part of this like massive global conspiracy thing that also involves I think interdimensional beings and just everything you could possibly imagine. So we had this idea, and then he finds out about it, and he's got blah blah blah. So we had this idea, we pitched it to Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who I become friendly with, who they were Eagle Heart fans and were amazingly supportive of me trying to do this weird stuff. And then we're like, yeah, we think it could be like a mainstream thing. A lot of people don't know about this whole conspiracy world that's out there. And we think it's really funny. And like, there was an Alex Jones type. This is before anyone outside of like fringe internet knew who this guy was, knew any of this stuff. And so we pitched it, we sold it to Warner Brothers. And then we wrote draft after draft for like a couple of years. And then Trump came along, and then all this stuff happened. And we were like, yeah, this is like conspiracy world is not funny nor fringe anymore. So that was, I mean, that was a direct, like, to what you're asking, like, that was like, yeah, that the world is different. That idea of like this funny thing, hey, do you know this out there? It's like, yeah, we know this is out there now, and there are like real world consequences for it. And so so that was one thing. The other thing I was working on, where I was like, well, maybe it's not going to work out in movies or TV for me. So I started working on this idea for like, I wanted to build a fake museum that was all about, it was like a fake presidential library about this president that never existed, that I just said had kind of been wiped from the history books that existed sometime Depression era, of this kind of like bully president who was like a hoarder and filled the White House with garbage, and like just worked for about a year on this idea and was about to start trying to raise money for it. And then Trump started gaining steam, and it was just like, well, you can't do anything about a horrible president now. So yeah, I don't know if those were like premonitions or just feeling it or seeing the writing on the wall, but yeah. So that was, everything. Yeah, everything changed.
It is interesting that you were sort of interested in ended up being themes of this movie before they became as important as they were. I was wondering, because it's like you look at your IMDb and there's sort of these like gaps of things and you'd be working. And I remember you were saying, you know, in 2018 or 2017, I guess, Sasha did Who Is America, and he talked to you for that and you were busy. And I was like, what were you busy doing? Because it's like, but it's like just more of this.
I was busy actually, like, obsessively. Well, first, I think I told him when I met with him, I was like, yeah, I'd love to work in this, but I'm really focused on this museum right now, which is one of the stupidest things anyone's ever said. But I was also doing this documentary project, which I am still doing and hopefully going to finish now. So, and that was like, it just felt like, I mean, to me, I love Who Is America. And I was like, I want to watch this show, but I know, I mean, there was probably a selfish thing in there, which I might have been wrong about, where I felt like, but I remember that meeting not feeling like whoever was going to direct this would make a real impact on the show. It felt very straightforward. It felt like he's doing interviews as these characters. I think I was wrong about that, because I see the process and how he kind of gets a group of collaborators, and it all does change so much and evolve. But I remember thinking, oh, well, just directing this will be just like segment directing, and I'm really trying to make this passion project happen, and I don't want to step away from it right now. But when the movie came my way, I remember thinking, oh, well, this is something I could really dig into and really make an, you know, influence. I could really influence it. Yeah. So that's so, the difference.
Yeah. You've told the story of when Sasha came to you and you explain, you got the script. You didn't say it was Borat, but it was clearly Borat. And then you like had this meeting where you explained why he shouldn't do it. And this is the narrative that you've explained. And has the ability to ask the follow-up question, why did you do that? When you were reading the script, were you like, this is going to be awful? I mean, like, clearly you weren't, but were you like,
no,
oh, I'm going to meet with a Kersey? Oh, were you like, oh, maybe I'll neg him, and then he'll, like, ask me to do it?
No, what happened was, it's kind of a misquote from the first interview I gave about the movie, which is basically, that's only the first half of what I had said, I think, because my actual answer, and maybe I was just kind of rambling then and I didn't finish it, which is very possible, very likely. But basically what I said is, yeah, I got this script. I read it. I thought it was hilarious. It was really exciting. What I came in and said was almost every version of this is a mistake, is a disaster, because you made the funniest movie of all time. You know, yeah, to follow up that is going to, you're almost certainly going to disappoint people. To do something 14 years later is even harder. You know, to do something with a daughter sounds like it could be, you could cast the wrong person. That could be just really groan inducing, really terrible and corny. And, you know, there are just so many, and also like you have to do it in secret and you could just get busted and the whole thing could not work. The second half of what I said, like after the comma, after that is I said, but if you pull this off, all that stuff would make it even more incredible. The fact that there's this much against this movie going in, if it is a movie that could be a worthy follow-up to the original and do all these things that he was already, by the time I got there, trying to do, which was basically introduce this kind of emotional narrative element, do much more with narrative and an emotional story than he was able to do with the first one or with Bruno or with any of these movies well, I mean, those are the two movies that he did in this style. But just to have a story that you actually cared about, to make it a two-hander where you cared about both characters, because there's Azamat in Borat, there's his boyfriend in Bruno, and they're great. They're both played by really talented performers. You don't care about that relationship the way that we were hoping you would care about Borat and Tutar, his daughter. And on top of that, he was saying from the first meeting, I want to move the needle on the election. I want to do something. I want to, even if it doesn't influence, even if it doesn't change the election, I want to be able to say we did all we could to either, you know, motivate people to get Trump out or to demoralize Trump voters who are maybe in the middle and are just kind of get to, not through a specific scene, but just through the whole thing, kind of see even a picture of, you know, just be kind of faced with what America is under Trump and make a decision of do we want to continue this?
I was wondering, like, you start soon after that interview. You know, no one else does what he does. And you know, you talked about how close he works with his lawyers. Is there, like, an onboarding process? Do you, like, get a rundown of, like, well, this is how we do it? Do you talk to Larry Charles? Like, how do you learn how, like, you've directed things before, but to, like, know the vocabulary of, like, so that you can actually, like, take the reins?
This, yeah, I mean, it's similar. I think part of the reason he originally talked to me was because I had directed a few episodes of Nathan For You, which is, you know, same world, very different thing, but also you're working with real people. You're not telling people what to say, but you're kind of getting stuff that you can help shape a narrative out of. And you're also creating awkwardness. In this, there's a lot more of not really saying what it actually is. Obviously, they don't know they're in a comedy movie. They're there because they don't know who Borat is. And we've hired them for, you know, we've picked them for very selective reasons, but this is, I would say, much more delicate than a thing like that. But yeah, no, there was a lot of learning of how they do this, because like you said, he is the only person that does this specific thing. It's not a prank thing per se. It's a Sasha movie. So like, a lot of the, what we call the field team had come from Who Is America. And they're the kind of team that goes out and finds the real people through a million different ways that are super, you know, protected and delicate and different entities and kind of all these tactics. And, you know, a lot of it on that show, they were used to booking political figures And this, it was all about, you know, real people, normal people for the most part, obviously, besides, you know, Rudy. But still, they had the skill set that they developed on that show. And that was all talked to them by the people who had worked on the original stuff, like Todd Shulman, who was kind of Sasha's right hand for 15 years, I think, who was on this in a kind of a more consulting yeah. process. But a lot of it was the same team. It was the same DP as the original. Yeah, a lot of the same people. So it was a combination of kind of people who'd been with it since the beginning and then newer people. And the other thing is, yeah, he'd never really explained his process before, but because he was working with Maria, he had to explain to her. We had to teach her how to do what he did. Yeah. So no, it was a lot of learning along the way, but it all happened.
Like his process of how he gets in character, stays in character, and remembers all the things to say.
Yeah, basically that, and also what to do when you're losing somebody. Like he would say, you know, if you could just see someone get a little bit of a question in their eye, like, wait, is this a put on? If you say, because that's the situation is such a, if you say one thing that sounds false or sounds like a pre-written joke or just push it a little too far, people's antennas go up and they start wondering. And so he's talked about what he would do. He's like, you just look them deep in the eye and you just go like deeper into their eye and you go deeper into the character. And it's almost, I mean, I'm sure it's something like a hypnosis technique or one of those, you know, Keith Raniere kind of things sure. where you can just kind of control somebody. But he had to teach her how to do all that stuff. I mean, she was incredible and she was such the real deal that never really happened with her, actually. But yeah, it was amazing to watch him kind of teach his process to someone.
Got it. So let's talk about what writing means for a movie like this. So you say you were sent a script or an outline. You know, who worked on that? How did they work on it? What is it? You know, like there is like a group of people that are listed story by. There's a group of people that are listed as written the movie by. Then there's obviously this whole other team of people we'll get to. So who did the first step of it, and what is that step of it?
So the first step, as far as I know, because this is a little bit of this is before I was involved, but Sasha was about to go on Jimmy Kimmel around the midterms in 2018, had written another movie with kind of his crew of writers, and
which was based on the Israeli defense guy or something.
Yeah, he had written an Iran Morad movie, and was it gonna go on Kimmel? Didn't know what to do. He says he called Chris Rock and asked, "What should I do?" Chris Rock was like, "Just do Borat." And Sasha was like, "I don't think I could do that. I think everyone knows who Borat is." He goes, "Oh, just try it, and if it doesn't work, you know, don't air it." And he tried it. And what they learned from that is they just went, I think it was somewhere in Simi Valley area, Thousand Oaks maybe, and just learned, oh, there are a lot of people who don't know Borat still. And yeah, they filmed a bit with him and it got them wondering, and I think pretty quickly thereafter, like, let's see if we could figure out a new Borat movie in the era of Trump. And kind of because they, you know, immediately started making all these connections between what it, you know, Trump, what Trump has made of America and kind of the very fictional Kazakhstan of that movie, and kind of how those relate and how much America has become like that and kind of backwards in that kind of, yeah, that cartoony universe that they've created, like, since it in these very absurd ways. I had told him, I was like, I think you want to do this because Trump is the only person who beat you at revealing the ugliness of Americans. That's why I think it was a vendetta. And that's why he had to come back and do this. But so they went away for a weekend or a few days. I think the story by group is they beat out like an outline. Mm. They had the idea of a daughter. I think also 2018, that was much closer to the era of the kind of the peak of the Me Too movement. They were and they were focusing on Trump's misogyny, basically, I think was where how the daughter character came about. And to make this movie about misogynistic attitudes in America, and that would be the focus of it, in addition to kind of the overall picture. And so they had this outline, that, and that's, I think, just scenes, ideas for scenes, in basically, I think it was probably a 30-page document of just like purely an outline. And from that, they, so that was around towards the end of 2018, they fleshed that out into what we still called an outline, but it was more in script form, where you're writing the scenes, all the pre-written scenes, the scenes between Borat and Tutar, the scenes in the beginning and end that bookend the story, those are written in more traditional script form. And then the scenes with the real people. You obviously, we don't tell people what to say. So those are just kind of a half a page synopsis here. They go to a whatever, they go to a this and maybe this could happen, and with a few possible jokes, and then move mm-hmm. on. And that's kind of the version I got. It was probably 60 or 70 pages and somewhere between a script and an outline.
I was thinking, you mentioned the sort of frat guys that liked the first one a lot. And that's like when I think of the movie coming out, I feel like it previewed in my college. And there were like guys already dressed like Borat for Halloween before the movie came out.
Oh, wow.
And were there any conversations about being more deliberate about how jokes were received? Like, I think about like all the bros who are like making like the sleeve of wizard joke or whatever. Like, there were in the first Borat, there are jokes that are, I still pointed at misogyny, but could be misconstrued as, this is a joke I can use as a misogynist to be mis-. What are the conversations about, like, we need to make our angle clear, knowing just how the first one received, knowing that it's going to be reaching a wide audience, you have less control over things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Every hour of every day, we would pick apart. We would say, wait, is this a joke about misogyny or is this a misogynist joke?
Got it.
Because of everything with the daughter of showing a young girl in a cage, or all these, you know, different versions where she was different levels of feral, or how he would mistreat her, use a dog clicker or whatever, and be like, wait, is this the right kind of laugh or the wrong kind of laugh? Is this just being horrible to a young woman, or is this illustrating it? And a lot of times in scenes like that, what's funny is not how he's treating her. It's say like in the farm feed store, it's the real person's complete acceptance of this insane way that he's treating her. And that's what's funny and shocking. And if that is clear enough, that makes it to us that made it worth including and not a misogynist joke. But there was also lots of discussions, for instance, about the Wuhan flu song that he sings at that rally, where we were just like, well, are we just singing a hateful song to right-wing people and showing them enjoy it? And not even, you know, like, to what end? It's like, wait, is this going to just become an anthem for hateful people? And so, we were saying, well, if we can really show people actually cheerfully singing along to Chop Them Up Like the Saudis Do, first, the intention of it should be really clear. There shouldn't be any, we can't help what everyone does with it after the fact, but we can only control, you know, what we put in the movie, and if we feel like we've done a good job of making the intention of the joke clear, that's where our control really ends. And then we we just have to decide, is it worth it to make that point, to reveal that? Is it worth putting this out into the world? I mean, and then, you know, I was watching the footage of that day, and you're seeing a guy see Kyle in the audience in a public event. It's like, yeah, fuck these people. Yeah, good.
I think that is the moment where you're like, got it. This is not like an I'm on a boat situation where, like, people who are on a boat will, like, it is clear, you know, the angle so hard. It's clear what side people are on.
Yeah, and the angle, I mean, look, the angle in this movie is a lot clearer than the first one. The first one, this stuff is a lot more subtle. It's not a partisan movie in the same way. It's not, you know, it's making similar points, but it's doing it in kind of a more subtle way. These are less subtle times. And so, I mean, this is all pre January 6th too. I mean, right now there's no kind of both sides, or there's no reason to be like, well, let's pretend to be, you know, more neutral and you can figure it out. It's like, no, everything we were saying in the movie is so much more undeniably true right now with what that movement is. I feel good about all that stuff. And that was a whole other thing.
You mentioned table reads. Would you be table? Obviously, you would be table reading the clearly scripted parts. Would you then be sort of like improvising these scenes of these what the parts with real people? Would you be then essentially like casting those real people? Be like, pretend you are a minister or whatever.
The table. I mean, we basically kind of fleshed it out into something more of a traditional script for the table read, which is also why I think the table reads, really the only purpose were to show, will the structure generally work? Is this a story we could follow? Because those real people scenes, none of them in the movie resembled anything like these kind of demo versions that we did in the table read. And the laughs we would get in those had no bearing on whether the scene actually worked in real life, because they really just depended on who the real person was. You know, would you know, what happened on the day, that kind of stuff.
So let's talk about the crisis pregnancy center scene. It's a culmination of a series of events that have to build up to it, in so much as, like, you know, it's classic early second act stuff, but you have to need her to eat the baby at the cupcake. But to set that up, you have to have in the beginning Borat's boss ask for a cake. So how does a scene like this start of a sort of a germ of an idea and then get to the point where you're like, okay, well, this is how it's all going to connect together?
So the germ of this idea was Jenna Friedman's, who's a brilliant comedian writer, who came in and was like, we have to do something about these crisis pregnancy centers. And most of us weren't familiar with them. Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah, most people aren't familiar with them, which if you don't know what they are, it is basically these Christian organizations that set up that look like abortion clinics, essentially, or yeah. women's health centers or Planned Parenthoods. And they just say women's health or pregnancy center or something that doesn't tell you that they have a religious affiliation. There's often no religious iconography. They're often made to look like doctor's offices, and they say, come in and get a pregnancy test and we'll give you help. There are options. And they kind of make you think that one of the options is that you can terminate the pregnancy. And then when you go in, and you say, yeah, you know, if a young woman would say, oh, I'm pregnant and it was a mistake and I'd like, you know, to explore ending it, they'll say to you, well, first off, before you do that, you should know that God loves your baby and doesn't want it to die. and just kind of do all of these very intense psychological things on a young woman to get her to keep the baby. And Vice did a really good undercover thing that we saw that's on YouTube. And so we learned all about these things. And she's like, you have to do something. We're like, oh, okay, yeah, well, that's definitely the type of thing that we would do in this movie. Is that going to be too dark and too much of a bummer? And so Jenna kind of came in with a lot of the idea. And then, you know, the room kind of tosses it around and punches it up. But it was like, well, what if we could set up a situation where she eats a baby doll or something like that? She's telling it to this pastor there who is kind of, you know, masquerading as a medical professional or whatever. And she's saying, you know, I have a baby inside me. I need to take it out. And then revealed that her father is the one who got her pregnant. And so it's kind of, and it's a lot of my favorite stuff in the movie is taking, you know, this is kind of a classic comedy setup of this misunderstanding, but it's doing it in the real world with a real person playing the, you know, quote unquote straight man. So the person who doesn't understand, and you have these two kind of clowns.
It's like, who's on first, and the other person literally is a baseball manager who's confused.
Right, and every detail that she's repeating that we already know, when she phrases it, it kind of escalates it where, oh, he did it, you know, he said he would give me a treat, and that's why he did it in the alley so no one can see it. And it's just, we know in this guy's head it's the most horrible thing. And so it's doing like kind of almost a traditional comedy setup, but using a real person. But on top of that, you have this very clear satirical angle, which is the kind of thing that makes it perfect for this movie, which is ultimately you have a pastor faced with a young woman saying that she's pregnant with a baby this is, you know, horrible to say as plain as it is, but she's saying this is a product of an incestuous rape, and he's telling her, no, you have to keep this baby. So it's doing this extraordinarily dark thing, but in this kind of very familiar comedy setup. And so we're like, yeah, if we could get that to work, that could be a really funny, memorable, crazy scene. And so then we wrote that up, and honestly, that was one of the scenes, actually, when we knew the jokes of that one. And so that was probably one of the scenes where in the table read, because that's mostly what's funny is the jokes and a very straight reaction from the person, where we were just hoping we would get someone who really would just say, you have to keep the baby. It doesn't matter. It's all in God's plan, faced with this unimaginably horrible situation. And so we then set about finding a place that would do this. And that took months and months and months. It was one of the hardest things for the field team to book, because these places are so non-trusting of, you know, a company comes in and says that we want to film you. These places have been screwed over before. They You know, and look, they believe this stuff. This is their movement. This is, they believe it's, you know, it's as simple as murder, and that's that. And that's the most important thing to them. And it took a while, and we had, you know, there's all these things that the field team does that are kind of all these, this very delicate process. And then finally we found a place and we filmed it there. And even that, there were hours and hours and hours that went into that day that kind of all led up to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do you prepare on that? How do you prepare with the act? Do you, you know, are you rehearsing that day to sort of make it clear what the jokes are? How do you set up a scene like that? Because they, you know, like, how does a day like this really produce itself?
We were on the road and the schedule was very tight and the scenes would change all the time. That was a scene we knew we wanted to do for a while. And we would typically rehearse the scenes the night before with Sasha and Maria in a hotel room, wherever we were. And we would, you know, this is pre-COVID, we'd crowd like a little crew, with someone from each department, and know, because at the same time, we're still coming up with ideas for props and for jokes and this and that. So we have writers and we have Rebecca Tendick, who created all these incredible props for the movie, like just spur of the moment with zero resources. And we have our AD, Duncan White. And we just have this tight little room. We rehearse it, we come up with ideas. And the writers are kind of typing up every new joke they come up with during that, and preparing them so that Sasha and Maria can learn these jokes. Because basically what we do is rehearse different scenarios. And if this real person says this, here's something you can say. Yeah. And if they say this, if it goes in this direction, here's something you can say. And here's the basic concept of the scene. These are lines we need that we know we love and we want to get. And then here's some other things. Oh, if this happens, this could happen. But also, so much of it, they would just improvise and really come up with something new and follow a scene. And that was some of my favorite stuff, where Sasha and Maria would just find something new and indulge in it and take it to a place. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's not like a regular improv scene where you can just say action and let actors go wild and say, okay, let's do another take more reined in. It all has to exist within the confines of actual reality for this real person. And it can never feel like a comedy sketch or a shoot like that in any way.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. I feel like, you know, for the last, I don't know, a couple decades, people are like, you know, we're going to have heightened characters, but it's going to be grounded. It's going to be real. And it's hard to know what that means because, like, it's still a fictional thing. But here you have heightened characters and it actually has to feel real. And you are seeing this firsthand. What does that look like? What does it mean to see this happen? I just sort of can't imagine it. Because, like, to us, like, we already know it's a joke. But, like, you're there and you have to be, you're playing a part and you're not on camera, hypothetically. Like, you're being a documentary filmmaker or whatever.
I'm playing a part. I'm blonde, first of all. I don't look like myself. I have like an actual look. My name is Chris. I bleached my hair for most of the last year to do
it. Does seem like two Jews, like, what should we name a not Jewish person? It's like, yeah, oh, yes, his name is Christopher.
Short for Christ. Or yeah. And no, I would, I mean, yeah, he just thought it would. I mean, he's done this for a long time. He's like, you need to look a little less Jewish and more trustworthy to the people in the Deep South. And he was completely right. I'll tell you in that, because sometimes people do, there are all these things that we do that Sasha does before the cameras are filming. There's a lot of reality setting. So that it's not just cameras, crazy guy walks in, says jokes and leaves. There's a lot of kind of massaging, there's a lot of off-camera things, there's a lot of care that goes into doing things that would never seem like, why, if you were doing a joke, why would you do this? Yeah. And most people aren't set up to examine this environment in that way. So we have ways of just kind of getting what we call our guests in the mode of, well, this must be real. Or if something strange happens, well, that's not what it was about. That's just something actually going wrong.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one example. This is the first day of shooting. When we're in the hair salon, and the hairdresser is like, can I see your hair? And Maria pulls her skirt up. And it's like this very uncomfortable moment. Right after that, the woman looked over with a real, like, what the fuck is this look on her face? Like, yeah. She was like, okay, hang on. Because we did that right away. As soon as they walked in, she's like, can I see there? And she's flashing her. So that was a very aggressive way to begin that shoot. And she's like, hang on. And I come out because I'm just like hidden around the corner. I think I was in like a little cubby or something in that place in a real hair salon. And I come out, what's going on? What's wrong? And And here's what we did. And this is just, this wasn't planned, but both of our instincts just went right to this, is Maria started crying. And I went over to comfort her. And I was like, no, you didn't do anything wrong. This is a cultural thing. You misunderstood. It's a language thing. And I think it's, if I had gone over to the hair stylist and was like, nothing wrong happened. This is real. These aren't characters. That would only be like, okay, well, now you're trying to convince me. Because I went to comfort Maria and she really was crying and she's like, did I do something wrong? That kind of short-circuited her doubt. Because that wouldn't make any sense if this was a joke. and so there was one moment in, so my name is Chris, I'm blonde, I'm shooting this thing, I'm generally not even acting like I'm paying attention, because there are, you know, when he's saying these weird things, like if I was actually a director and I was watching and he's confessing to getting his daughter pregnant, I would come in, or the guy would talk to me, I'd be like, yeah, this is a disaster, I'm so sorry. Generally, I'm acting like I'm not paying attention when I actually am. So if they come and say something to me, which happened a few times, I could be like, oh, I'm sorry, I was on a call. And so the one thing that happened there is sometimes we push it too far. I think Sasha maybe said one or two lines that just pushed it a little too far. That was after we got what we wanted. You kind of, his whole thing is just pushing as far as possible. Seeing what we can get, obviously. It's all about pushing everything to the extreme. And occasionally there'll be one joke that just feels a little too much like a leading thing or a joke or something. And so the guy, the pastor in that scene, comes out and he's like, hey, can I talk to you, Chris? I was like, oh, yeah, what? and he's like, something is going on here. I don't know what it is, but that guy in there, who he had believed up until that point was completely legit, just kind of a weird foreign guy, he's like, he just said this one thing, I think, about Donald Trump. It sounded like a joke. He's like, look. And I was like, oh, fuck. Are we, you know, busted or whatever? He goes, I think that guy might be pranking you. I said, what? He says, I don't know what his deal is, but I wouldn't be surprised if he had like a hidden camera on him or something. And I was just blown away. I was like, wow, that's how good this blonde hair is, that you're not thinking of the three non-hidden cameras that are right in your face in that room. So
how do you get out of that?
We make some calls. We say there's a misunderstanding. He didn't mean that. And you just kind of, you finesse the situation. And that was, I mean, that was one part of the directing job. I think it was Todd Shulman who used to do a lot of that on Who's America and just kind of make things okay. And then, I mean, there are certain scenes where you can't. Debutante ball, I couldn't. We just had to escape. Police came. They came to like beat the shit out of me. And like, I had to escape out the back. I heard people like running down the stairs yelling, where the fuck is Chris? And the cameraman was saying there were like eight guys like pulling their coats off to like beat me up. But yeah, sometimes you can't talk your way out of it. But then sometimes you try to smooth things over and just get out of there.
We'll be right back with more Jason Molinar.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
And we're back with Jason Wolner. I want to ask you this about using real people. And it's a thing that I think about with this, or I thought about with Nathan For You, which, you know, the idea of punching up and punching down is sort of thrown around a lot and sort of just communicates the idea of, like, there's a power imbalance between the subject and the target. And this is not meant to be, like, provocative. Like, but, you know, here's this dude, as you reveal, like, clearly morally dubious, but though he represents a sort of larger problem, you know, you guys are, you know, wealthy members of the cultural elite or whatever. And Minim, you know what's happening and he doesn't. You know, how do you think about it in those terms? How do you feel about it? How do you account for that?
Yeah, to me, I mean, it's just about determining case by case, is it worth it? Is revealing this worth it for, you know, the cost of whatever that is? If it is someone who is what I would consider to be actively doing harm in the world, even if they're at a different, you know, I don't know what that, for instance, that pastor's level of society is, but I have no problem using him. I'm not saying he's an evil person. He has very different beliefs, but to me, it's worth it to be able to use him to reveal this attitude that I do think, I mean, good people do a lot of harm in the world, or people with good intentions do a lot of harm. And, you know, even someone like the woman in the cake shop, who is very sweet, who I don't know her at all. I had no reason to think she's evil. But that scene is, you know, he comes in and asks her to write "Jews Will Not Replace Us" on a cake. And I mean, there was no finessing. That was the first minute of that shoot. We walked in and she's like, okay. And even if she's not anti-Semitic, right there, if it makes the tens of millions of people who are going to see this think about, you know, compliance and complicity when evil things are asked of you or are happening around you, or think, you know, that to me brings up an interesting enough point, could be thought-provoking enough that makes that kind of thing worth it for sure.
The other thing I was thinking, you know, like in journalism, there's like a general moral question of whether you should help people or be a neutral observer, right? Like, and, you know, if you're something's happening, you're like, should I help this person on the ground or write that someone's on the ground? You know, for people like Jim and Jerry, the guys who Borat lives with for 5 days, who seem like completely poisoned by QAnon, but otherwise seem like really sweet guys and really care for Borat. Do you feel like, oh, maybe we should tell them to, like, I understand why you do it, like we clearly talked about, like, but part of you, how do you think about, like, is there a way at the end of this we can also, like, help get these guys out of it? Are you ultimately like, that's not my job? I'm curious. Like, I'm not saying you should.
That's so interesting. I mean, I never even considered trying to get those guys out of, you know, being Trump supporters or what have you. I think it certainly wasn't, I didn't feel like my job to try to change anyone's attitudes in that. It felt like we could find people and shoot with them and use these scenes to illustrate certain broader things. Mm-hmm. I liked Jim and Jerry. I enjoyed spending time with them. We lived in that house for days. Like, I feel like their brains are poisoned. Yeah. and I was just watching some deleted stuff with an interview with Jim. And this is from a year ago, and he's talking about things that you would think that he said them last week because they relate so specifically to what we're seeing happen right now. And to me, filming with those guys is such a clear line to the moment we're in right now. I didn't think there was any convincing. I didn't think I was going to save anybody from Trumpism in this movie.
Can you say how you found those guys? Was that like was that just luck? I mean, like, or you maybe can't say that, like, of all
there's
people.
No, they just do a nationwide search for people, basically. Because we had to look through, for this movie, thousands and thousands of people. Because not only are we finding people that don't know who Borat is, don't know who Sasha is, we're also finding people who don't know who he is, who are willing to be on camera as part of the, you know, almost everyone in the movie knows they're in this film project. They don't know exactly what it is. But so the people who don't know who he is, who are willing to be on camera, but who also you don't feel bad for, who don't feel, you know, helpless or feel like they're being exploited. It's people who have a sense of self, who can defend themselves, who believe, you know, who have convictions and carry themselves with a certain amount of confidence. So that, you know, we never want it to be like we're just bullying people. And And so, yeah, I don't actually know the specifics, because by the time we would see these people, it would just be field team being like, oh, we have these possibilities, you know, these, we've met these people, and we saw those guys, and we say, oh, those, it would be great for Borat. If we can make that happen, it would be so great if Borat could live with those guys for a few days. And then we had to figure out how to do that.
You mentioned the debutante ball and the guys were trying to beat you up, or there's the gun rally thing where it seemed like it's also quite dangerous. I know Sasha had to wear a bulletproof vest on that. You know, I'll never forget the first time I listened to Sasha on WTF years ago, and he talked about getting sort of addicted to the danger of really pushing it and really being with real people in that way. Like, and he was talking about the Bruno scene where it really felt like maybe the most dangerous thing he's ever done. But he's also talking about a little bit like you get addicted to it. You want to see how far you can push things. As you mentioned, he wants to see how far he can get it. Having now been exposed to it, one, sort of what was scary, and do you find yourself also having now this desire to sort of chase that going forward?
That's, you know, the people who have worked on his stuff in the past say that it's very hard to go back to normal stuff, because you don't, there is such a, when you get away with something, you get, you're, it's such a rush that it is like the closest to being like able to like rob banks legally because, you know, so much work is put into making sure we're not doing anything illegal ever.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the cops were called so many times, not because people think that we're doing a comedy movie, it's because people don't know what's going on. They think you're like robbing them or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You're acting, because you're here with a crew and you're acting so shady and this guy is doing these weird things and you're escaping. Like, there's just like, it feels like there's a crime, but there's actually never any kind of crime. But then there is a lot of escaping from the cops and CPAC, you know, Secret Service too. There's Secret Service everywhere, and I'm running this whole thing over WhatsApp basically.
Yeah.
And people are eyeballing me, and I'm sitting next to, you know, just regular attendees, and I'm clapping at, you know, speeches, and I mean, it's nerve-wracking. And he was detained after that and eventually let go. This is a very specific high, because you're doing this stuff with the best and basically only person in the world who does this. And Sasha is able to do these things because millions of people love them. It's not... he's able to get the resources to do it right, so that we can have the, you know, security measures in place and legal measures in place and have the best First Amendment lawyer in the world to really figure out. We call him every day in the middle of the night. Can we do this? Can we do this? And sometimes say, no, you can't do that. Or, you know, most of the time it's like, oh yeah, I'd love to do that. Yeah. If you get that, if that goes to trial, I'd love to defend it. Like, just a very bold lawyer who's a genius, who knows everything. And, you know, it's rare that you get that kind of resource and this ambition to push things as far as possible. At the same time, you know, I have movies I want to do. I have other things I want to do that, you know, wouldn't involve getting chased from cops. So, I mean, it's great, though. It's super fun. I would definitely, I imagine I'll do something more like it one day, but, you know, hopefully a mix.
Maybe this is an editing question, but I'm curious with sort of a balance for a scene like this. You know, the person is real, but if you do too good of a job, it strains the credulity for the viewer. Like, you just, especially if you're a skeptical person, it's like when they're watching magic, they're like, well, that can't, like, it's almost like if it's too good, how do you account for this?
That's what happened with Janice, the babysitter, is that was also the first week of shooting. And that was the kind of the first thing that went really great. And that was the first time that was really, Maria was in character the whole day with her, including hours when we weren't shooting and she was just staying in character and just hanging out with Janice. And I mean, there's a whole scene, a sequence we shot where she takes her downtown to a city and like they explore together and we just kind of cut it for time. But they had a real adventure together. And Janice reacted so, you know, perfectly to everything Borat did. And also when she's in the car and telling her she's going to go get plastic surgery, reacted better than we ever could have hoped and was really real with her and genuine and saying, you're beautiful, mm-hmm. You don't need to change. You know, we didn't give her, we don't tell people what to say. We just hope for we try to get the right person and then hope that they'll, you know, say things that work for the story or what we want. And Janice was, you know, beyond our wildest expectations to the point that we came back and showed that to a few friends, like a small pool. And people were like, so wait, so she was an actor? And we're like, no, she's real. She's real. And people were like, oh, are people going to think she was an actor?
Yeah.
We did something in the editing where one of the last passes of editing, like the scene in the car, first thing we did was take all the music out of that scene. We had score in that scene that was kind of low emotional score about her trying to convince her not to get the surgery that made it feel more filmic or more even like a reality show because of how it looked with these little dashboard cams. We took the music out of it. Suddenly it felt more real, felt like a real conversation. And then we edited in, we had a lot of editors who passed on this. I think it was might have been Eric Natarnicola did a little pass of just adding in a few more hesitations, false starts of words, pauses, stuff that wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
Some of the editing, and I remember this on when I worked on Nathan For You too, is some of the editing is leaving in some imperfections too, so that your brain doesn't think, well, this is just fake, this is written. It's just kind of, there's a few little moves you can do that make it clear. And then of course the other thing that happened is when the movie came out, Janice went public and talked about it, and you know, there's this whole thing where, you know, ultimately it was great and ended well. I should hope convinced anyone beyond the shadow of a doubt that she is just a legit, real, wonderful person.
So this movie, maybe more than anything else, really gets at sort of the dangers of misinformation. You know, propaganda is not new, but with, you know, it's different with social media and a postmodernist lack of agreed upon truths and institutions and the loss of context that the internet fosters. And the movie captures that in particular, how all that feeds into the sort of right wing information universe. However, this movie in its own right blurs truth and fiction in its way. It's part of what's so exciting about it, you know, is things are real, things are not real. You know, but maybe to some particularly not media savvy people, they don't know where that line is. Have you ever thought about how, though you're not contributing to this conspiracy theories, you maybe are like further playing into a time in which reality and fiction are continuing to be blurred?
We did everything we could. It's a great question. We tried to be very intentional about which parts of the movie were real, with real people, with non-actors, unscripted, you know, unrehearsed, where, you know, we have our two characters with real people who are really just reacting or in their own environments or being completely real, versus the scenes that are fake, the scenes in Kazakhstan, the scenes between Borat and Tutar when they're what we call the horse box, which is an English term for horse trailer, but now I call it a horse box because I've been around English people for a year and a half. You know, we tried to be very clear with that. And something even like for instance, when he runs into Tom Hanks at the end, in that montage, you know, shot that in a very stagey way. That's green screen. There's a you know, Sydney Opera House behind him because, you know, it looks like a late night thing or something. You know, like we wanted to, beyond a shadow of a doubt, because that thing would only be a few seconds long, make sure it was very clear that we didn't actually ambush Tom Hanks, because also no one would believe that Tom Hanks doesn't know who Borat is. So things like that. So, and that was something I tried to be very intentional about, because I think you don't want that layer of confusion on top of the kind of, already it's a lot of, I think, mental work for a viewer in this movie specifically to go between these kind of classic Borat interactions with real people and then go back into this, I'm watching a story that I'm supposed to be emotionally invested in mode of their like horse box scenes at night. So, but yeah, we did, you know, everything we could to clearly delineate kind of who was real versus who was just a character.
Oh, side note, when Tutar and Borat are speaking, what language are they speaking? Are they speaking the same language? Are they speaking
No, they're not. No, no. So Maria, who plays Tutar, is speaking Bulgarian because she's from Bulgaria. And then Sasha is speaking kind of a combination of, I think, Hebrew with some Polish, maybe. I don't know how much gibberish it is. I think it's a lot of Hebrew and Polish and that stuff. And then actually the guy who plays Nazarbayev is speaking Romanian because we shot that in Romania. It did give us the ability to change what they were saying after the fact, because I think like there was a version where he's going to the cake store to get a cake for Nazarbayev, and then there were other versions of why they went inside, and that was a subtitle that changed a few times. When we're like, oh, wait, we could set that up and that's what brings him to the cake shop. And then, you know, like, so yeah, yeah. Sometimes we would kind of retrofit ideas, you know, as the story evolved backwards. Oh, we could set this up and have him say this and then have that, you know, something like when they pick Rudy in the pickup truck. That was a scene where we kind of reconceived the scene after we shot it to be that's what she's showing him on the phone and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You know, originally, yeah, it was something that happened in the fax store. And, you know, that's just like an editing thing that, yeah. that evolved. Yeah.
So let's talk about Rudy. So both you and Sasha have been pretty clear what you thought of it, which is that is not how he would have acted with a male reporter. That is not how someone takes off a mic. After the news came out, but before the movie came out, I wrote a piece less about the scene and more about the reaction to the news of it. A piece that, as I was telling you before, your dad emailed me about that he enjoyed. Yes. So your dad endorses it. So not sure you read it, but I will summarize it to any listeners who hadn't. But so I found the news coming out sort of inevitable, but a little bit of a bummer because I think it sort of overshadows that you actually made a movie that was really impressive. And I also think it reduced the points you're making a little bit. It sort of became, oh, this is the movie where they get Rudy Giuliani, not the sort of movie where they depict the state of America. And, you know, also it sort of overwhelms, like, you know, Maria's performance and scene, which is incredible. And it does this thing that happens so often where comedians get lauded for the things they do, opposed to like the fact that they are comedians that have successfully made comedy. They're like, thank you, Sasha, you're a great political force, opposed to like you made art, which is not necessarily mutually exclusive. How did it feel for y'all? Did you feel like, you know, walk me through it? Maybe, you know, partly it's exciting because like obviously there's all this attention to the movie, but also it's now all the attention is this one part of it.
Yeah, I mean, from where I was standing, it all felt very positive. I felt I didn't mind it at all because to me, the bigger concern with, you know, obviously so much changed when COVID happened in terms of this movie. We incorporated it in the movie. We decided, you know, it was originally with Universal. It was going to be in movie theaters. That was one of the things I was most excited about, was kind of getting a shot to do a similar experience to what I had and what everyone had 14 years ago. And then the world shut down. And, you know, of the million things that are fallout from that, it became very clear that if we wanted to put this movie in theaters, that wasn't going to happen before probably, you know, this spring or summer. And there was a version, we could have rewritten a ton of it and made it not about the Trump era and gambled that he would lose. But, you know, we kept going back to, that was the reason for the genesis. It wasn't just to make money. You know, it was to get this out before the election. It was to give a snapshot of how America has changed under Trump. So to me, the big concern with moving to streaming and Amazon was just the streaming landscape, which is, it's so hard for anything to kind of make a splash in the way that movie did, in the way that, you know, that nothing really blows up, almost nothing, you know. And at that point, this is, you know, late summer, early fall, we'd spent the better part of the year in COVID lockdown, and I mean, what was there? Tiger King? There was like very little culturally. I think because we were all like in this kind of depressed, just like pause of like, well, let's just stop everything. Even though things came out, nothing was catching fire. And the other thing was, a week before the most like tense election, probably certainly of our lifetimes, is anyone going to want to watch this movie? Is anyone going to want to laugh at this? Is anyone going to want to talk about this? By the time we put this out, is everyone just going to be completely sick of Trump or of COVID? Is anyone going to be willing to watch a movie where COVID is any part of it when we've just been living in this nightmare all year? So those were all my concerns of, you know, I had a much bigger concern that it would just kind of go out and disappear into the noise of politics and of the streaming kind of world. So we were able to keep it secret until three weeks before we released the movie. And then the review embargo lifted, and it was the day after Rudy tried to put out that Hunter Biden laptop thing. I think then The Guardian did a story with that kind of, I think now iconic image of him lying on bed with his hand down his pants and her standing above him, and it just felt, I mean, it was like, I think the cover of the New York Times, it was like the biggest story in the world. So, I mean, when you have a scene in your movie that's one of the biggest stories in the world, it's hard to complain about it. So, yes, at the same time, it did become the thing. Yeah. But I think that's what anyone could possibly want, is a reason for everyone to have to watch something. And so then, you know, even at that time, no one had heard of Maria Bakalova. Like, that was, so that was that weekend. So I feel like it did work out the best because it got everyone aware of it and watching it, and it became this cultural moment. And then everyone saw it, and millions of people fell in love with her and loved the two of them together, and saw, you know, and really loved the movie. And so I have no complaints at all about how it kind of went down.
Did you, what were the sort of contingencies, like, you know, what if Rudy didn't work out? What, like, you were just, did you, what if he stopped at the earlier stuff? Like, where, what were your beats? What are your outs? Like, obviously this is like, I can't imagine you would expect anything more that was also like not dangerous and like terrible to put a person in. Like, it really was exactly where I imagine you'd want to stop.
I mean,
like,
there was a chance, you know, Sasha comes in as a sound guy early on. There was a chance that Rudy sees this guy who looks like a Peter Sellers character and is doing this insane voice, and he's just like, he leaves right then, you know? There was a chance that would happen. We hoped it wouldn't happen, but it could have just blown. Like, all these scenes, every scene we do, we know it could blow up immediately. Yeah. And we face that a lot. And things just, you know, sometimes things wouldn't work out. And there were a lot of days where by the middle of the day was a complete disaster. By the end of the day, we had gotten something magical and great. And that was the same thing. We just rehearsed it with Maria in steps. And, okay, if this happens, this, and this happens, this. And, you know, we didn't know he was going to lie down in the bed and, you know, do that. And, like, that was great. If that hadn't worked, we had backups of other, we had other people we could try, but Rudy was the first. And I'll only say this because it's already been made public. It was a story last week. Because otherwise, I don't generally talk about plans that don't work out. But we had the MyPillow guy, you know, booked. We were going to shoot with him. And I was like, yeah, there's a version where that's funnier. It's so low stakes, but that guy is a, you know, horrible piece of shit, and it would be great to fuck him over. And and that would have been funny. But we wanted, you know, we were hoping to get something with Rudy.
In what ways is this a Jason Wallner movie?
That's a good question. I don't think there's one kind of simple way. I feel like I can talk about, you know, there's like specific structural things I gave, or scenes that I really pushed or encouraged, or scenes that I really thought were a wrong direction, which we didn't wind up going. You know, it's really, on a job like this, there's something, I think my career has kind of been divided in these two paths, where this one where I'm kind of just like a facilitator of things, of the work of people I love. So I went such a Mr. Show fan growing up, and then I got to do the Bob and David thing when they brought it back and got the whole team back together, and I got to direct that, and that was a dream come true. Or, you know, I grew up worshiping Chris Elliott, and then got to like do a show with him, and there's been a few examples of that where I started as just a massive fan of what I was a fan of, and loved it deeply, and studied it, and just have had the good fortune of being asked by certain heroes to kind of help them with their next thing, or help bring something back, or help further something, and so that's kind of one path. And then this other path, you know, is stuff that I, that on my own, like I was saying, it's generally harder to get going. It's more conceptual. It's you know, also Eagle Heart. It's these Gelman things that are more of a collaboration. You know, Brett and I came up together. We didn't, I didn't grow up, you know, worshiping him, but we made these things that were very personal to us and very powerful for us and meant a lot. And so, and this felt like somehow a convergence of kind of these two modes that I have, of this like, for hire, helping make more of what I love mode, and then also I genuinely care about this. This is something I feel like needs to exist, and I feel like only I could be doing, for whatever reason. And so, yeah, you know, I grew up worshiping Borat and Sasha's work, and but also I felt like, no, I really I feel like me involved in this is going to make it a specific thing that I can really help shape.
Is there a moment you can think of where you go, that's Jason? Were you like, or another way even thinking about it, like, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, when you look back at your career and Borat is now part of a series of projects,
right?
How is Borat going to fit into it? How, what are the things you know, when they play a greatest hits reel at your whatever award.
My funeral. I don't know. That's such a good question. I don't know. Because to me, like, the whole thing is, I just feel like I was able to, and I also didn't know, having not worked with him before, I didn't know would I just be kind of sidelined, or is a director in his mind? Because it goes without saying, it's much more of a Sacha Baron Cohen movie than a Jason Wallner movie. And so the question going in was, how much will I be able to impact what the final movie is? And when we got into editing, you know, the editing was so quick. You were editing along the way, but when we were actually done filming to delivering the movie to Amazon was like less than a month. Mm-hmm. And I basically assumed, I was like, I will be probably asked to leave at this point. I'm not a producer on the movie. I have no, beyond a director's cut, which is just kind of a formality often on something like this. Like, I was like, will I have any role in this? And I was in the edit till the very last day that we basically locked in. And so I was doing, because it was actually, we were actually doing a director's cut alongside other cuts that were going on, because it was all moving so fast. And then I would do cuts of scenes and throw it in front of him, and we'd throw it in front of an audience. We would screen over Zoom. We would screen in Australia when COVID, you know, it was safer to go to theaters. And so there isn't like one, I mean, there's jokes. I can tell you, you know, there's jokes, you know, here.
At the end of this answer, you're going to have to tell me one joke and then we can move on.
Okay. I need to think of one joke. I need to think of a good joke. I mean, and I don't even know, because I might be remembering wrong. I'd hate to take credit for something that actually was someone else in the room. But, I don't know. It's so collaborative. I'd have to think through the entire movie.
Yeah, go through again. Every line and tell me, oh, I wrote that one sentence.
Like, I think I was originally, I mean, I pushed for Maria, you know, just because I watched Sasha watched lots of auditions, hundreds of auditions, but I made sure I watched and studied every audition. And, you know, of the hundreds and hundreds, I think I was probably the first person to watch hers and say, I think this person is special. Bring that to Ant. We started, you know, lobbying him and you know, if anything, probably that was maybe my greatest impact, was quote unquote discovering her, but really just trying to find out of hundreds and hundreds of auditions the spark.
Why do you think Maria should be nominated for an Oscar?
Because I you know, I said to her on the first day, When I think she was maybe a little like shaken up, or did I do a good job after like the first day of shooting the hairdresser and stuff? And I said to her, I don't know if she remembers this, but I said, yeah, no, I think you're gonna get an Oscar for this. And it was just an instinct of like, oh, if you have someone that no one in America has heard of or seen that can go toe to toe with Sacha Baron Cohen, with real people, and get huge laughs in scenes, and do these scenes with him and actually make you care about this character's story and journey, and make you emotionally invested by the end. I feel like that's so rare. I can't think of anything else quite like it. Yeah.
I will say, when I watched it for, I guess maybe the third time, the very last scene where they do the news report together, and then it ends and he says, like, you did a good job or something, I cried. I was like, that is so nice.
Yeah, that's great. I was tearing up watching it. And we were, like, watching it live when we were doing it. And, you know, not to slam anyone else, but I did drive past a billboard the other day, like a four-year consideration thing, which they have out here in LA everywhere. And it was talked about someone's courageous performance. And I was like, well, when you talk about courageous acting, there is a lot of courageous acting, emotionally raw acting. Very rare is acting quite literally as courageous as being in a situation like when she does that dance, just being completely, like, truly fearless. Like, and Sasha too, like, it's just a different definition of courageous and fearlessness and performance, where you're doing a fearless, raw performance, but you're also, you have to be fearless. You have to be like, well, someone could, like, get physically violent with me. And so that, it just kind of makes a joke of any other kind of acting being referred to as fearless.
Yeah. So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because this is a comedy show. It's called The Laughing Round.
Great.
Cool. Great. Do you have a favorite joke? Street joke? Dad joke?
Jokey joke? Oh, my God. You know what? I was in the situation with Russell Crowe. back in the, to tie back to the beginning, in the like Human Giant days, we had this crazy night where Human Giant hung out with Russell Crowe accidentally, where we were, the head of MTV at the time, Tony DeSanto, was out in LA. We were all living in LA, and he was at the Beverly Hills Hotel and invited us to like a dinner. And we got there, and at the table already were Carson Daly and Pauly Shore. And so it was like this weird multi-MTV generation thing where we're like, oh, wow, we're the next. And then, you know, like, so there'll be someone after us. And we had this really nice dinner. And we didn't know Carson Daly or Pauly Shore. But then at some point, Russell Crowe walks by and he's like, hey, Pauly. I can't do it. Sure. Russell Crowe accent, but just acts like Pauly Shore is his best friend in the world. He's like, hey, how you guys doing? And he's like, I just had this drink, prickly pear margarita. You ever had that? Oh, you got to try it. It's great. Like, it's very kind of sweet drink. he's like, yeah, get these guys around to prickly pears. And he sits down. He's like, yeah, it's too bright here. He fixed that light. And, like, the waitstaff leaps on the table, unscrews a light bulb. Just, like, go, you know, really catering to everything he wants. We're hanging out with him for, like, 20 minutes. And then he leaves, and we're like, wow, Pauly, you know Russell Crowe? He's like, I don't remember ever meeting this guy before. And he thought he might have, like, passed by him in a hallway at, like, Conan or something once. And so, and then we wrap it up, we're going, and then Russell Crowe pops up again. He's like, hey, you guys got to hang with me tonight. We hung out with him all night in this, like, little corner of the table. There was, like, this, I mean, the one thing I remember is there were these two older women sitting by us, and he was just like, hey, can you get them to leave? And he got their table moved, and he was telling us all this stuff. Like, he loves comedy, and he wanted to do, like, a Bill Hicks biopic, and then he was telling us about that thing where he threw a phone at a guy's head.
Sure.
And talking about the paparazzi, like, hounding him. And he just, like, looks at Aziz. And he's like, you couldn't handle it, mate. But I just remember, that was the last time I was put on the spot like that, where he was just like, all right, we're going around the circle. You're all telling me your favorite joke. You're comedians. You're telling me your favorite joke. And I think I spaced then, too.
When I asked Paul Scheer this question, he told the exact same story and also didn't comedian joke.
That's probably the case, because that was, it's a very memorable memory.
What is the Human Giant sketch you're most proud of, or the one you point to and go, that's me?
That's, there were a few that were more filmic. Like one where Aziz is haunted by the ghost of a gay porn star, I remember liking. There was one called Reenactment that was about a mass shooting on the set of a reenactment show, and they do a reenactment of that. I mean, I can't imagine any of this stuff has aged very well. but I liked those. Okay, here's what. The one I'm most proud of was called Sci-Fi Makeup, and I wrote it, and it was about... I'd already decided I didn't want to just be like known as a comedy director, that I was really determined to show those guys that I could write. And that was when I was really happy with how it came out. It had like kind of a solid concept, which was that Paul Scheer played every like Star Trek or kind of Star Trek ripoff show at the time had like, you know, a weird looking guy, like an alien guy. And this was like a behind the scenes of a show like that. And he was the alien guy and had like 5 hours of prosthetics every morning and thinks the show is going to go on forever and is sick of waking up early and basically gets surgery to look, just like to make that look permanent. So they remove his ears and they dye his skin and they add all this shit to his forehead. And then, you know, of course he walks in the next morning and the show's been canceled. And then he's going on auditions. He's trying to like get acting work, but he has like an alien face and no one understands why. And it's just this very sad thing where we just follow his life kind of go down the tubes. because of this stupid decision he made.
So do you have a scene in something that you shot or in some capacity you thought was really, really funny that you go to your grave being like, this was so funny, and either you had to cut it out because people were like, this isn't funny, or audiences didn't respond to it, but you were like, that's one of the funniest things I've done and everyone else is wrong, or just it, everyone else isn't as right as I am about how this is so great?
I mean, probably Eagle Heart in general, I'm very proud of, and the world really doesn't agree. Not that they don't like it, but for whatever reason, we were never able. And that was kind of like, you know, peak TV era where everyone was like talking about TV in this way. Actually, Vulture and Josh Wolk were one of the only places that wrote a piece on Eagle Heart that I actually like made me probably cry at the time, because it was like the only place that wrote about the show in the way that I hoped that someone would write about the show. And everywhere else was like more or less a few exceptions, but most other places were like, oh, this is like a Walker Texas Ranger spoof that's on Adult Swim for people who are stoned at midnight. And Eagle Heart, the third season, was an attempt to really push that, to take this kind of cartoon elastic universe, but really wrap it around a very sad, tragic story that had actual stakes, that was kind of had some humanity to it. That was just about kind of the, in a very lofty way, the kind of like failure of comedy at fighting back at the world. That's like why jokes are ultimately powerless. And you know, life is, you know, through the Eagle Heart lens, it was very dark. It was kind of about the meaninglessness of life and the futility of anything. But there was also joy in it. And because it was also within the episodes was kind of about the joy of discovery of one idea leaping to the next and of just being stupid and making each other laugh. So there is like joy within this kind of very dark shell. But I mean, for years, we were just scratching our heads being like, why? We don't understand why. You know, we had a few Comic-Con panels, but it's not like people were getting Eagle Heart tattoos or dressing up like him. And we had this like, I mean, at the time, and it all seems so goofy and quaint now, but we really were so jealous, I would say, of a show like Children's Hospital, which, and a lot of our friends work on that show. Yeah. I obviously have dear friends who worked on it, but it had this very fun vibe and it had this huge fan base and it was very jokey. And we thought, well, oh, we'll get that for us. It'll just be people who are like a little more like our kind of people, a little probably darker, a little more like miscreants or whatever. I think those kind of people don't respond to the things in the same way. And like, they don't go to Comic-Con.
It's not like, let's have a party at this panel. They're like, let's stay at home and read a book about it, whatever.
Right. So I still like, I mean, the one thing I'm probably, still kind of stubborn and wrong about is I still feel like there's an audience for that show. I mean, we're approaching in a couple of weeks is 10 years since it started. And the first season, about half the episodes were good. The second season, I think, was really good. And the third season of it is probably the thing so far, that and maybe the second Brett Gelman special, that I'm kind of most proud of putting out. I would say it's almost completely undiscovered, but it is like, if you watch the third season, but like the third season is like this 2.5 hour movie that tells a story from beginning to end that just either the world didn't want or wasn't ready for, but maybe one day there will be enough of an audience. But it is, last week it got put on HBO Max. So, I mean, maybe people will discover it there. That would be, that would be,
I think,
fun.
So after listening to this, everyone here was not gonna listen to it. Wait, I want to ask you one more, which is when I think about Borat, the first one, I think of the movie and then I think of the deleted scene where the guy at the supermarket shows him cheese, but he goes as this rice, and it's a type of, there's a few of those in the movie, but it's also a type of joke that is so funny to people who write comedy but takes so much time.
Yes.
Does one, will this Borat have deleted scenes in an era where, like, I guess there's not really deleted scenes anymore? And like, do you have a scene that is like the modern day Is This Rice?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I hope there's a way to put that stuff out there. I mean, there's like a 12-minute cut of him in a scene that is just, you see 1 second of in the trailer that didn't make it in the movie, of him just trying to learn how to play golf with this guy who's very similar in tone to like the driving instructor in the first movie. Yeah. Just a very patient guy, a little bit gruff, and he just can't believe how stupid this Borat guy is. And watching that, it was really magical. But the one that I laughed the hardest at, which we only put a few moments of in the movie, is when he is in the barber shop, when he's being a barber to raise some money. And I was crying. I was in a car right outside because the barbershop was too small for me to hide. And so I was right outside watching on monitors and just tears streaming down my face because it was like we shot that twice. The first guy was probably the funniest but we didn't use it because the guy looked kind of like he could be poor. He wasn't. He had a job. He actually had a good job. He was a respectable guy. But his look was he had like a white beard and he just had kind of a very gruff, kind of a hobo look. And we were like, and so it was so funny on the day, but you watch it and it was like this just, he feels too much of a low end target. It felt mean spirited. And then the other guy was great. It was just kind of a middle class guy. Again, and not a target we were ridiculing or trying to take down, just an extremely patient man. And Borat is there. You know, there's probably 15 minutes where he would cut a piece of hair and get the guy to approve every hair that he cut off his head. And that's the kind of thing that would never make it into a movie at anywhere near, just like the cheese thing, at anywhere near the length that it is. But to watch that in real life, I was dying. Yeah. So hopefully in some form, hopefully we'll figure out a way to get that stuff out there one day.
That is great. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Well, that is it. The end of interview. Thank you so much. Thank you for everything.
Jesse, thanks so much. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it was. I was so excited to, especially after Dad reached out. I was like, oh, his dad's going to listen to this. I got to do a good job. That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Borat's subsequent movie film on Amazon Prime Video. Follow Jason on social media at Jason Wolliner. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. Scott from Shrikishin did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us @goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me @JesseDavidFox. And if you haven't, please check out my new Patreon podcast, The Specials. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with London Hughes. Have a good one.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.